spoken to. El Mencho, unlike, some of the leaders of the Sinaloa cartel, for example, he was a very shadowy figure. He didn't call a lot of attention to himself, and he's been sought by, three Mexican administrations, multiple U.S. administrations. So this is somebody who was wanted for a very long time. Obviously, the timing of the raid as well, in advance, of the World Cup. There are going to be games scheduled to play in Guadalajara. That all makes for a particularly dramatic situation. Obviously, the violence as well, across parts of Mexico, all on the day on Sunday, was very dramatic. But as the president, emphasized in our morning news conference yesterday, across most of the country, the situation is calm, was calm. The retaliatory wave of violence really was something that showed the breadth of the territorial reach of the Jalisco New Generation cartel, which El Mencho was the leader of. But the real question remains to be seen whether this kicks off what often happens, which is a fracturing and infighting in a large criminal organization that then creates a sustained wave of violence that targets, of course, security forces, but also civilians all across sectors of society. So that's really the concern, whether this is going to create a wave of violence, or whether this is something that the Mexican government, they've sent, some 2,000 troops to Jalisco, the stronghold of the cartel, or if this is something that the Mexican government will be able to control. It's also unclear, based on the structure of the Jalisco New Generation cartel, what exactly the succession plans could be, but also what exactly a fracturing might look like, unlike with the Sinaloa cartel, which fractured and has created sort of spectacular and terrible violence in Sinaloa due to the fracturing in 2024, which resulted because of the which was kicked off because of the capture of El Mayo in the United States. The Jalisco cartel is a much more sort of decentralized franchise-based operation, so it is not clear sort of whether there are strong entrenched rivalries that will result in the sort of unfortunate and terrible ongoing violence that we're seeing in Sinaloa.
And Laura, I wanted to ask you, the Sheinbaum's predecessor, AMLO, really sought to tamp down this this heavy-handed approach to the cartels in Mexico. Could you talk about the difference since Sheinbaum has come in as president in her approach to combating drug trafficking, and to what degree U.S. pressure has forced her hand in this?
That's absolutely excellent question, Juan. Thank you so much. As you know better than almost anyone, this long-running U.S.-backed drug war is a combination of pressure from the United States as well as efforts by, governments, whether Colombia or Mexico. Felipe Calderón obviously declared the war on drugs in Mexico in 2006. So, and yes, in 2018, López Obrador was elected in a landslide victory for various reasons, also, widespread frustration about inequality and injustice in Mexico, but also in large part because of frustration over this drug war and the U.S.-backed drug war, frustration both in terms of U.S. pressure and frustration in terms of, the Mexican role leading this drug war. Unfortunately, there it was a real mixed result from López Obrador's efforts to use social programs to combat the insecurity in the country. His social programs, which are, which Sheinbaum has continued and which are widely popular, historically reduced poverty, and that was a huge success for the government, and that is something that the Morena Party is continuing to prioritize, not only because it's popular, but because it is reducing poverty across the country. Yet at the same time, we saw López Obrador's administration, the homicide rates ticked down, but many security experts say that the cartels also became more entrenched, expanded to new illicit industries, were able to sort of further control territories. So it was complicated. And when Sheinbaum came in, which of course comes in the context of, US President Donald Trump's election and then taking office, immediately the Sheinbaum administration stepped up the war against the cartels deployed forces to Sinaloa, which at the time was both locked in a bloody battle that continues, but also was the absolute number one priority for the U.S. government, because the U.S. government blames the Sinaloa cartel, principally the Los Chapitos faction, for the fentanyl crisis. So that was seen as both, you know, important in terms of Mexican security, but principally under a lot of U.S. pressure and a huge priority for the U.S. government. Since Trump came into office, all of the pressure continues, you know, and I think we have to understand the El Mencho raid in the context of the January 3rd military attack in Caracas, in Venezuela, by the U.S. Special Forces. That sent shockwaves all across the region. And there's a real sense in Mexico and beyond that governments need to show the U.S. that they are willing to take, willing and able to take military action on their own, lest Washington send special forces into the country. So in general, this raid is being considered, is being seen as a signal that that President Sheinbaum is sending to Washington. We not only can, but will take these types of, you know, unprecedented military operations, but do not send special forces into the country. This is a red line in Mexico.
Laura, can you talk about the new U.S. Joint Interagency Task Force counter cartel that you report played a key role in the Mexican military raid on Sunday?
Yeah, my colleague Phil Stewart in Washington interviewed the head of the Joint Interagency Task Force counter cartel ahead of the raid. This is a new task force set up by the Pentagon under President Donald Trump. There's not that much information available about it. Its mission is to, you know, dismantle Mexican cartels and cartels, particularly along the U.S.-Mexico border. I think it's important to note there have been and continue to be various interagency, you know, Pentagon interagency cartels. And in general, what we've seen over many, many years, but accelerated under President Trump, is extensive coordination between U.S. law enforcement and the U.S. intelligence, so-called U.S. intelligence community, that's the CIA, NSA, you know, the more than a dozen U.S. intelligence agencies. There is more coordination than ever between the law enforcement and the intelligence agency side to share information, compile information, get information, and then that is all compiled into what are called these targeting packages. There are these detailed dossiers, and that is shared with the Mexican government. That's not new. We've seen sort of these targeting packages and information sharing happening for quite some time under multiple administrations, but it is definitely accelerating under President Trump. In part, that's because of the FTO designation, the fact that President Trump, when he came into office, he directed the administration to declare various Mexican cartels as terrorist organizations, including, of course, the Jalisco New Generation Cartel. That unlocks authorities within the U.S. government to use more money, more tools, more resources to get intelligence and then to share intelligence internally. We're still all, I think, trying to really understand what the impact of this FTO designation has been internally in the inside the United States government, because what we can see on the surface is really just a fraction of what's happening underneath, because most of that space is classified.
I'd like to bring into our discussion another guest, Alexander Avina, Associate Professor of Latin American History at Arizona State University, who's written extensively and research about capitalism, the U.S.-backed war on drugs and state violence. Professor Avina, I wanted to ask you, this enormous firepower of the cartels in this raid once again demonstrates the flood of arms that has come into Mexico from the United States. I'm wondering if you could talk about that, why these cartels are so heavily armed.
Good morning, Juan. Thank you for having me again. Yes, over the last few years, there's been sustained, really good reporting by Mexican and U.S. journalists that indicate something like 80 to 90% of the weapons that are captured from different drug trafficking organizations come from the United States. Indeed, President Sheinbaum mentioned that, I think, yesterday during her morning press conference, where she said something like 80% of the weapons that they've taken from the Jalisco cartel come from the United States. There was really excellent reporting earlier this month about one particular U.S. Army-owned ammunition plant in Lake City, Missouri, that makes the 50 caliber ammunition that is designed to take down transport and even light aircraft. And while the U.S. military does use that ammunition, it also sells it to the U.S. domestic market. But there's very little demand from the U.S. domestic market for bullets the size of cigars. So those bullets actually are being sold to Mexican drug trafficking organizations. And they're part of this broader flow of weaponry and ammunition that go from north to south, that helps, that just represents one driver of the type of violence that we see in Mexico that affect everyday Mexicans on the ground.
Yeah, and in terms of the Trump administration's repeatedly threatening President Sheinbaum, claiming her government wasn't doing enough to combat drug cartels, what's your assessment of how the Mexican government has tried to deal with this issue in the past?
Yeah, Trump has infamously said, you know, things like he personally likes President Sheinbaum, but she's scared and the cartels are actually running the country, which is, I mean, as we witnessed on Sunday, that's patently false. You know, what happened on Sunday is just part of a longer, you know, decades long approach to drug interdiction that is highly militarized, that focuses on punitive actions. And that in the end only ends up generating more violence and doesn't do anything to stem the flow of drugs. So I think symbolically and politically, it represents a victory for President Sheinbaum. It allows her to assert that, you know, she's doing, quote unquote, doing something about the most powerful drug trafficking organization in Mexico and likely the Americas. It allows her to stave off some of the pressure from Trump, right, to assert Mexican military power against these criminal organizations. But we know that this is not going to do much in terms of stopping the flow of illicit drugs from Mexico into the United States. If anything, based on recent past, we know that this is probably going to lead to some sort of internal struggle within this drug trafficking organization, which will only lead to intensified violence on the ground in local communities and the places and the geographies that it controls. It will also probably embolden rival groups to try to take over territories, production zones, and smuggling routes. So that will also intensify the violence on the ground. And this is just a phenomenon of the so-called war on drugs that the U.S. has led globally since the end of World War II. The burden of this war always falls upon the very bottom of the hierarchy within this political economy, on the poor, on poor people, on poor peasant farmers, on low-level street dealers, on low-level consumers. And so what we're going to see in Mexico, unfortunately, likely, is an intensified violence on the ground. That the type that we witnessed yesterday, right? The main victims yesterday were, you know, communities across 15 states that suffered something like 250 plus road blockages and attacks by, you know, gunmen belonging to this Jalisco cartel as a way to, for them to project their power and to kind of terrorize local communities into submission.
Laura Gottesdiener, your latest piece that just came out today for Reuters talks about the cartel and perhaps others putting out fake news accounts of what's taking place right now, the reaction in Mexico. You're contending making it look worse than it is to the attack.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. I completely agree with Alex. I think the roadblocks, the disturbances have a dramatic impact on communities across the country. There is also, at the same time, a propaganda effort of both these roadblocks, but in the digital space. That's what we were looking at late last night. Because at this point, the Jalisco New Generation Cartel wants to try to create a narrative that the Mexican government is not in control of the country. There are certainly parts of the country in which the state really does struggle to assert control, provide basic functions, and particularly security. But their goal is beyond that. They want to create, especially in the context of the World Cup, especially in the context of widespread tourism to Mexico, they want to create an international image that there is that they have more control of the country, that the Mexican government is unable to govern, essentially a crisis of governability. And so what we were looking at last night is the way in which AI-generated images and fake news spread across the internet. According to researchers, that was not just unsuspecting people sharing sort of stories to get clicks, but it appears that that was actually part of some version of a coordinated propaganda campaign by organized crime to create this additional space in which they are fighting for the narrative. The roadblocks were very real disturbances in which they are fighting for the narrative on the streets, but online they were also fighting for the narrative of this question of who governs the country. And so I think we have to really look at this online space, especially now that AI has become so incredibly ubiquitous, and understand, you know, what are crime groups doing in this space, and how it is a new terrain of struggle, of propaganda narrative struggle for them. They've used social media for various tactical communication reasons, fake recruiting for quite some time. But this is sort of, it appears that this is sort of an escalation of the propaganda war that they wage online.
Well, I want to thank you, Laura Gottesdiener. One last question.
No, I just wanted to ask Professor Avinia what your sense is of how the U.S.-backed war on drugs has impacted this issue of corruption within the Mexican government.
Oh, an easy question, Juan. I mean, it's, you know, corruption is something that's structural to the international drug game. So it's not even just corruption that allows for this political economy of narcotics to function within Mexico. And indeed, the rise of this political economy began within the confines of the post-revolutionary authoritarian state that was led by the PRI throughout the 20th century. But this is a feature that characterizes the political economy of illicit narcotics and drugs globally. So for it to function, it also depends on corruption within the United States government as well, within different U.S. security forces. And as we've now known, and we've talked about in the past, we know that since the end of World War II, the U.S. has used the so-called war on drugs as a way to advance geopolitical imperialist ambitions in Latin America. It gave them one more tool to try to exercise control over countries in Latin America through a militarized approach to drug interdiction. And that hasn't necessarily changed. We witnessed it at the end of last year with the kidnapping of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the whole phenomenon of narco-terrorism. And we're seeing something. We're going to continue to see this throughout the Trump administration and beyond, whether there's a Democrat in power. The style and the rhetoric will be different, but the war on drugs will continue to be used as a way to advance U.S. empire in the region. And again, to stress this point, the burden falls on the poor people in Mexico and on poor people in the United States. And we never get back to the fundamental question of why poor people are turned to the economy of illicit drugs in Mexico, and why so many Americans, a disproportionate amount relative to the global population, feel the need to turn to illicit drugs to get by on an everyday basis. I think those are some of the more profound questions that we need to keep posing.
Alexander Avinia, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Associate Professor of Latin American History at Arizona State University, and Laura Gottesdiener, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist based in Monterrey. We'll link to your recent articles. This is Democracy Now! Coming up, we speak to longtime war crimes prosecutor Reed Brody about law and accountability. From the International Criminal Court's hearing on former Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte to the growing fallout from the Epstein files. Stay with us.
One little star smiling tonight knows where you are. Stay, little star, steady and bright to guide me afar. Rush, little
Someone by Lila Downs, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with a longtime war crimes prosecutor, Reed Brody. He's been closely following a number of stories that revolve around law and accountability. From the international fallout over the Epstein files to this week's hearing in The Hague on whether former Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte should stand trial before the International Criminal Court, to today, this fourth anniversary of Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine. Reed Brody is a member of the International Commission of Jurists and author of To Catch a Dictator, The Pursuit and Trial of Hossein Habré. Reed, let's begin with the arrest of Peter Mandelson, the former British ambassador to the United States, accused of passing confidential government information to Jeffrey Epstein while he was serving as Britain's trade secretary. His arrest comes days after the also arrest of the former Prince Andrew. Neither of them are being charged for abuse of minors or girls and women, though the emails are, to say the least, stunning and horrifying between them and Jeffrey Epstein after he was known to abuse children. But talk about what is happening abroad and what is happening here at home as a result of the fallout from the Epstein files.
Well, it's really crazy how you have throughout Europe all of these heads rolling and all of these arrests and relatively little accountability in the United States. And I think one of the reasons we're seeing, all these Epstein-related arrests across Europe is that prosecutors and police are generally independent of political power. I mean, the Metropolitan Police did not have to ask anybody to go and arrest Peter Mandelson or the former Prince Andrew. In the United States, the federal prosecutors and the FBI are only going to investigate those people who Donald Trump wants investigated. And so there is no prosecutorial independence in the United States. There have been calls, and I think, for a special counsel to investigate the Epstein affair.
Here.
I mean, that would be what would normally happen if there's a conflict of interest. But, of course, we know that in Trump's first term, when Jeff Sessions appointed Robert Mueller as special counsel, he was fired. So there's not going to be a special counsel. There's not going to be, investigations of political figures here because the Justice Department in the United States has been acting like Donald Trump's private law firm. I think there are a number of other, I get asked all the time in Europe, why isn't there more accountability here in the United States? And I think that's one big reason. I also think, the class issue that Ro Khanna is always talking about, how these are billionaires, who abuse working class women. I think that's resonates more in European societies somewhat than in American societies. But I think, this cannot be the end of the affair, so to speak, for the Epstein file. I mean, we're going to see this continue.
Reed, there was a panel of independent experts appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council that has actually called for an independent and impartial investigation of the alleged sex crimes contained in the Epstein files. And the panel said, quote, so grave is the scale, nature, systematic character, and transnational reach of these atrocities against women and girls that a number of them may reasonably meet the legal threshold of crimes against humanity. The importance of this effort, and do you think it has any prospects?
Well, I think, there can be international investigations. The problem is that the actual files, the actual power to call witnesses and to get to the bottom of this is here in the United States, is with federal authorities. And, of course, some states now can take up the slack. I mean, in New York State, there is no statute of limitations for the worst sex crimes. So you could see state prosecutors taking this up.
I want to turn for a moment, we're trying to get to a lot of issues in these few minutes, to the ICC, the hearing ICC at The Hague around the Filipino President Duterte, who was arrested and being held there.
Well, I mean, this is a monumental event for the Philippines. I mean, the former head of state, the former president, these are confirmation of charges hearing to determine whether he should stand trial for having allegedly ordered and instigated the killing, the extrajudicial killing of alleged drug dealers. I mean, thousands, potentially tens of thousands of Filipinos have been killed. Ironically, speaking of double standards, these are the same crimes which Donald Trump has presumptively committed by the strikes that you reported earlier in the Caribbean, the extrajudicial execution without due process of alleged drug dealers. But Rodrigo Duterte is in The Hague and Donald Trump is in the White House. I think, you know, this is also a watershed moment for the International Criminal Court to have a former head of state in the dock. You know, in 24 years and at a cost of probably $3 billion, the International Criminal Court has never successfully captured and prosecuted and convicted any state official anywhere, much less a former head of state. And so, you know, Rodrigo Duterte probably thought he was home free. But, you know, you also have a number of other people who've been indicted by the ICC, Vladimir Putin, Benjamin Netanyahu, Min Aung Hlaing of Myanmar. So a bunch of former heads of state out there, but they haven't been brought in. The International Criminal Court does not have a police force. So this is a major moment for international justice and for the ICC.
And Reid, we only have about a minute left, but I'm wondering, the world is marking the fourth anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. There are no signs of it stopping soon. President Trump promised on day one he'd end the war here. A year later, it's still not ended. Why does peace seem so out of reach?
Well, I think, you know, this is a policy on both sides of endless war. I mean, talking about, you know, accountability, the Russian invasion and Russian crimes in Ukraine have led to probably the most coordinated international justice response in history. I mean, the International Criminal Court has indicted Vladimir Putin and his Minister for Child Affairs for thousands of Ukrainian children who were kidnapped. You have four other, the former chief of staff and defense minister and two generals who have been indicted for attacking Ukraine's civilian infrastructure. You have tens of thousands of cases, war crimes cases going through the Ukrainian courts. And you have the recently created special tribunal on aggression against Ukraine that may prosecute Russian leaders for the worst crime that was committed, which was the invasion of Ukraine. All these accountability things are moving forward, but peace doesn't seem anywhere closer than it did 4 years ago.
We want to thank you, Reid Brody, longtime war crimes prosecutor and member of the International Commission of Jurists. As we end today's show, fallout from the BAFTA Award ceremony in London Sunday is growing. That's Britain's equivalent of the Oscars. Filmmaker Jonte Richardson has quit the judge and the award, citing the organization's handling of a racist incident during the ceremony. When Michael B. Jordan and Delroy Lindo presented the award for Best Visual Effects, a Tourette Syndrome campaigner shouted the N-word. The BBC failed to edit out the word from the broadcast, which aired 2 hours after the live show, while cutting the phrase "Free Palestine" from Wael Davies' acceptance speech, one of the award winners. Jonte Richardson wrote on LinkedIn, quote, "After considerable soul-searching, I feel compelled to withdraw from the BAFTA Emerging Talent Judging Panel. The organization's handling of the unfortunate Tourette's N-word incident last night at awards was utterly unforgivable. I cannot and will not contribute my time, energy, and expertise to an organization that's repeatedly failed to safeguard dignity."
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Ducks Unlimited Canada works with landowners and other conservation-minded partners to improve outcomes for communities and wildlife. Supporting vital ecosystems which contribute to water quality and quantity, soil health, support agriculture and economy, mitigate severe weather events, and provide opportunities for recreational access to nature. Together, we are unlimited. Learn more about programs and partnerships at ducks.ca.